Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about one of the most critical moments in the history of relations between Japan and the United States. Certainly a point that is a very important event, maybe the most important event in the history of modern Japan, and that was the forced opening of the country to the rest of the world that happened in 1853 when Commodore Matthew Perry sailed in with his fleet of warships. Matthew Perry, generally, is considered, at least on this side of the Atlantic here in the United States, is considered a hero for compelling Japan to open up to the outside world. But our guest this morning, George Pfeiffer, says that, in fact, most Japanese believed that the treaty between the United States and Japan that resulted was, in fact, a humiliation, and that this loss of sovereignty stung and continued at least as far up as World War II. He makes the argument that this forced opening of the country led directly to Japan's military buildup, and ultimately you can make a connection between Perry and his sailing in with his gunships in 1853, forcing open the country. You can make a direct connection between that and Pearl Harbor. All of this, some of the ideas that you can find in George Pfeiffer's new book, which is titled Breaking Open Japan, Commodore Perry, Lord Abe, and American Imperialism in 1853. That's the subtitle. The book is published by Smithsonian Books and is in bookstores now, so if you want to look at it, you can certainly find it. George Pfeiffer is the author of many successful books, most of them about Japan or about Russia. He's written for a wide variety of publications, including The New Republic, The New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and Saturday Evening Post, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We only ask people who call in just to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible, but anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Pfeiffer, hello.
Mr. Inge, good morning.
Well, I'm glad you could talk with us. We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Apologies for this rotten voice. I'm not the thug who killed Litvinenko, although I sound it in London. I sound like a Soviet thug. It's just that I've lost my voice yesterday, and it's recovered in time.
Well, I hope that it will not. The experience here of having this conversation will not be uncomfortable for you.
It won't be uncomfortable. I hope you won't be uncomfortable if I tinge my praise with one tiny praise of your summary of this very difficult book in the sense that it's revisionist.
Yes.
I think the summary was brilliant with one tiny little qualification.
Yes.
Yes, I think that Perry's forced, I want to emphasize, forced opening, as you did, of Japan was led immediately to Japan's ultimate overriding priority, build big ships with big guns, so this will never happen again. Never again will we be humiliated this way and forced to eat crow and do other people's will. But it didn't lead, I wouldn't say, it led to Pearl Harbor, no question about that. Mm-hmm. It was the first, not absolutely the first connection between America and Japan. There were others which we perhaps can get into, but it was the first real meeting, first substantial meeting of America and Japan, and it started with a bully slapping around someone whom the bully took to be utterly inferior because he was Japanese and the bully was, in general, white and Western and specifically American. Americans thought they were better than anyone else. And, of course, the Japanese were humiliated and made miserable. But it didn't lead, I wouldn't say, directly to Pearl Harbor, because there were several things in between. However, you're right when I say that that humiliation was never for a moment forgotten in the 88 years that separated Perry's opening of Japan with his big guns and Pearl Harbor. Americans who, and I included myself in this until I happened to stumble on this subject, I'm not now, chiding anyone else. I was as ignorant as anyone else. But Americans are paradoxically, I think, ignorant of other cultures. I say it's paradoxically because we're the one great superpower. We probably have more military power vis-a-vis the rest of the world than any single country in the history of the world. And as we have grown in power, we have diminished in understanding or even interest in other cultures. It's amazing. Our foreign bureaus of every single news agency are closing all over the world, just as we are exerting our power all over the world. What does that say about us? But as I say, we don't realize what effect we had. And if things had been reversed, if in 1853 a fleet of Japanese warships had steamed into Chesapeake Bay and then toward Washington, undefended Washington, and issued an ultimatum about certain things they didn't like in America, let's say about a problem that gnawed at us terribly, Commodore Perry, a great man in many ways, but certainly not a great diplomat. Commodore Perry was constantly criticizing the Japanese, whom he called savages, and criticizing their society, which was in fact superior to our own by certain measures. Of course, that's always a subjective question. But he was calling them savages and criticizing them. Well, they didn't have a single problem like our slavery. But supposing that a fleet of warships had steamed into us and told us what to do about slavery or any other domestic problem. Our society was hardly perfect. Theirs was hardly perfect. We criticized them. They didn't criticize us. How would we have felt? You know, I've spent most of my years abroad writing about other people, and it slowly occurred to me that although the cultural patterns are very different, and we ought to spend a great deal of time studying them before we open our mouths, but the basic emotions, I think, are quite similar. And my guide for these sorts of things is to try to put myself in their shoes. How would we feel? How would we have felt in 1853? I don't think there's anything remarkable about my thesis. Certainly, it can be argued with, and I hope it will be today. Certainly, you can say, quite rightly, that Perry's opening of Japan brought Japan a lot of good, together with an awful lot of bad about which we never hear. That's all for argument's sake. But you've got to say that nobody likes to be told what to do by a foreign power. So, just to sum up with Pearl Harbor, and I think then we can dispense with it, mm-hmm. just because that's the thing we know about Japan, we are full of outrage and self-pity about Pearl Harbor without really any knowledge of what the Japanese, who at bottom aren't really terribly, at bottom, I don't mean culturally, but at bottom in emotional things, aren't really very different in us. And we have no idea about what might have provoked this. Am I justifying Pearl Harbor? Of course not. Am I justifying Japanese atrocities in World War II, which people always ask me about every time I raise this thing? Of course not. These atrocities were loathsome, hideous, as odious as has been written about, awful. But you know, they came about after we, I think, provoked them. When Perry steamed into Japan with his black ships, as they were instantly known, with the implication the color usually has, when Perry steamed into Japan with his black ships, Japan was bothering nobody, with the possible exception of Okinawa. Japan wasn't irritating us. Japan wasn't bothering us or fouling us up in any way. Japan was doing no harm to anyone. Japan was trying to preserve its security by hiding. And so they had no navy. They had no national navy. They had no army. It was Perry who provoked them into their great crusade during the next 100 years. Enrich the nation, strengthen the military, as their own mantra had it. Now, that's my peroration. Please shoot me down.
Well, I'm not sure that I am in a position to, although I think that it is true that I guess as I have always read about and heard this event discussed, that the view, certainly the American view, and one gets the impression that the Japanese view was that while the opening of the country occurred, this might not have been the way that they would choose to have done it, that in fact the forced opening of the country, the Meiji Restoration that came 17 years later, and the very rapid modernization of the country would be argued that in fact that was a good thing for Japan. And I guess it was my impression that the Japanese thought they would have argued the same. Yeah.
I think it was, in the long run, a terrible thing for Japan for this reason. The modernization was coming. Perry, I don't want to draw too many parallels between Perry's action and our present situation in Iraq, but Perry knew virtually nothing about Japan. That wasn't entirely his fault because, as you know, Japan not only secluded itself, but did its best to hide everything about itself. Perry knew virtually nothing about Japan. He certainly didn't know that Japan was on its way to opening by itself. And anyway, I'm not making the argument that good things did not come in with the modernization. Of course good things came in with the modernization, together with a lot of bad things. Of course feudal Japan had to fall, and of course good things. I'm making a narrower argument, and I would like to keep it separate. How was it done? It was done by a man in a foreign uniform. It was forced upon them, so that even Japanese who recognize that many good things came about as a result of Perry's forced opening, even those Japanese, of course, resent him because they forced him to do it. If Japan had been left alone to open as it was doing on its own, in accordance with its own wishes, its own needs, its own desires, its own cultural patterns and interests, then, of course, it would have had modernization on its own terms. And I don't think you can never say what if in history. You can never be sure. But surely the history of the Pacific, which was anything but Pacific during the next 100 years after Perry landed, it was bellicose. The ocean should have been changed to the bellicose ocean. Surely the history of the Pacific, surely, well, you can never say surely, but almost certainly the history of the Pacific wouldn't have been different. Look what happened immediately after Perry landed. Japan militarized, and the Meiji Restoration, which you speak of, was, despite its democratic trappings, essentially an engine to militarize, to become powerful. Look how amazingly quickly they became powerful. Look at the phenomenal big ships they did build, so that within 50 years of seeing their first steamship, that was two of Perry's black ships were steam, the first times they'd ever laid eyes on any steamship. Within 50 years, they defeated, to everyone's astonishment in the West, they defeated a European power, the Russians. Within 50 years, they started from nothing, from scratch. So, again, I say, yeah. Don't answer my argument with the other argument that good things came in with modernization. That's separate. Of course they did. But how was it done? How would you feel? What would you remember if it had been done to us that way? What would you feel now if a country steamed in here and by force made us straighten up our act, get our act together so that we don't have so much poverty? Or in 1853, as I said, so that we got rid of slavery. We were the nation that clung to slavery well after the European other supposedly less progressive European nations abandoned it. What would you feel, David? I think you would have felt what I would have felt. Anger, resentment, underlying resentment. A mixture of feelings, yes. Surely there is... There are some in Japan who are wholehearted supporters of Perry, who don't make any of my arguments, but the overwhelming majority feel hurt. And they still feel that they're not a real normal nation, because we still, in a sense, run Japan. I'll get into that in a moment if someone will ask me about it on the telephone or if you will.
Well, let me introduce again for anybody who might have just tuned in, our guest, George Pfeiffer. He is the author of many books about, many of them either about Russia or about Japan, and he has a new one that looks at this event in the history of both Japan and the United States, that is the forced opening of Japan to the outside world in 1853 by Matthew Perry. His book is titled Breaking Open Japan, and Smithsonian Books is the publisher. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It is true that when Perry arrived, there had been in place for a couple of hundred years a policy maintained by the military government of Japan of very strictly controlling contacts between Japan and the outside world and Europeans. I think that it is also true to say that the country was not completely sealed. There were relations between Japan and the outside world, but maybe you
Korea,
can talk a bit about
China
and also the Dutch.
Yeah.
Although, as I say, it was very tightly controlled.
Very tightly controlled. Yeah.
Perhaps you could talk about that, and maybe also a little bit about why it was that back in it was in the late 1630s that the government decided that that kind of strict control of contact between Japanese and outsiders was necessary.
Let me begin in a reverse way with modern Japan. I love to demolish clichés as much as anyone, and I wish I could demolish the cliché that most Japanese people, not all, Japan is a big country, there are many exceptions, you can't say the Japanese. I hope you'll understand when I say the Japanese, I don't mean every Japanese person. But most Japanese in general, feel uncomfortable in the presence of Westerners. That cliché seems to me to be true. It wasn't true when the first Westerners entered Japan or came upon Japan in the 1600s. It wasn't, this was 15, what it was, middle of the, 1500s, 16th century. It wasn't true. They were hospitable. And very soon, certain numbers of Westerners were pouring into Japan. They were traders, Portuguese and Spanish originally first, then English and Dutch. They were traders, and they were missionaries, specifically Jesuit missionaries, Catholic Jesuit missionaries. And relatively large numbers of the missionaries were very successful. Large numbers of Japanese converted to Christianity, partly, I think, because of the appeal of Christianity, partly because they thought it would help them in trading with the West. Some of the feudal leaders of Japan, and at that time Japan, contrary to our impression of it as a kind of a tyranny and a unified state, at that time the central power of Japan was extremely weak, extraordinarily weak. Most power was really in the hands of no less than 260 feudal domains. And some of the feudal leaders made their subjects convert because they thought it would help trade with the Westerners. In any case, without going into full detail here, the expansion of Catholic Jesuit activity and the involvement of some Jesuits, some missionaries, in Japanese internal politics to the detriment of the always unstable and insecure central leaders who feared they would be overthrown. And the Jesuits did get mixed in, and some of the Jesuits did dirty their hands with big trading deals and things like that. That convinced the central authorities to exclude Jesuit activity. They couldn't do it. They found out they couldn't do it because the Jesuits kept on coming in no matter what measures they took, unless they kept the ships out that brought them. So slowly, at first, and then rapidly, with momentum, the country was sealed against Western visitors. Not hermetically, as you said. There was a speck of a Dutch colony off the island of Nagasaki, off the city of Nagasaki on a little artificial island. The Dutch were allowed to continue there with their trading under tight surveillance, as you've said, because the Dutch were thought to be not interested in proselytizing or in religion of any kind. The Dutch were only interested in commercial things. And, as I say, trading continued with Okinawa, with China, and with Korea. Through those sources, they were surprisingly well-informed about what was taking place in the rest of the world, while the rest of the world was almost a total blank about Japan. That was essentially why they closed, out of the usual reasons: insecurity, fear. And they decided that their security lay not in building up more weapons, as the West usually did, as Western powers usually did. Their method of security was to bury their head in the sand in the way and try to hope that no one would ever come to disturb their tranquility.
Well, let us talk with a couple of listeners here. We have some people who would like to join the conversation. We'll start with someone here where we are in Urbana, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, I read Mr. Wiley's book, Yankees in the Land of the Gods. Have you read that in your researches?
Yeah, I have, and I think it's a very good book because, unlike so many others, it attempts to tell the story from both sides, as do I think.
Well, he had access to imperial records from...
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to read unless you have a great bent for history and a historian. It's jam-packed with names and with a great deal of detail, but my hat is off. It's Peter Wiley.
Yes.
I think it's a very good book.
And he didn't seem to extend what I would call the repercussions of Perry's entry into Tokyo the way you seem to have done in your conversation with David this morning. And I've got to wonder, as history progresses, the effects of Perry's entry into Tokyo, I don't know if I can agree with your extension of the effects of that entry.
Well, you don't have
to
agree.
The way you seem to have done, because
yeah.
other events in history, other decisions made by those in power in Japan and other places also have an impact.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I don't mean to say for a second that Perry was the sole cause of either Japanese behavior in Pearl Harbor or Japanese behavior in World War II. It wasn't the sole cause, but it was. But I'm utterly convinced, because Japanese say so, that it was one cause. You speak to Japanese. You're right about Wiley. Almost every single book about this episode, Perry died within 2 years of his mission to Japan in 1853-1854. Perry's counterpart, the man I follow, his name was Abe Masahiro. Perry's counterpart died even before Perry, although he was only 34 years old, because the strain of trying to figure out what to do, whether to bow to this to the black ships with their monstrous guns, or whether to pursue a hopeless fight with them, hopeless because the samurai, despite their reputation, hadn't fought in 260 years. They were in total disarray. Their arms were rusted and so forth and so on. So he died even before Perry. Almost all histories end with, most histories don't deal with the Japanese at all. Most American histories deal only with Perry. We're not interested in hearing the other side. Wiley is the exception. You're absolutely right. But anyway, almost all books end within 2 years with the death of those two people. Yeah, it's my idea that history doesn't work that way, that the repercussions go on and on and on. For goodness sakes, it's 65 years after Pearl Harbor now, and the outpouring of articles in print and films on celluloid in America is phenomenal.
A lot of them are just hogwash, though.
Huh?
A lot of them are flat out.
A lot of them are hogwash. That's right. It's centuries since the Sunnis, to switch again to Baghdad, the Sunnis, or to Iraq, the Sunnis and the Shias had their controversy, and passions don't seem to be quelled there. My theory, and it's only a theory, these things are speculative, is that bad things or harmful things or hurtful things stick in a country's collective historical memory much longer than the opposite.
Oh.
And I think, I can only say, I spent a lot of time in Japan talking to Japanese experts in this field, and they told me, I certainly didn't have this feeling about Perry. I was a naval officer. I shared the ordinary American feeling that Perry was a hero until I heard the other side.
And
now, you might think,
now,
as I did before I got involved with this, that the Japanese don't have that feeling. But I no longer think that because I talked to them.
Is there a particular phrase that the Japanese associate with Perry?
A phrase? No, I don't know.
I mean, like...
he's a great man. I quote one person...
The captain of the black ships or something like that, just to pull that out of the air?
No, but I will say this. If you read a little more closely about Perry, an utterly brilliant naval officer who was responsible for all sorts of progressive advancements in the American Navy.
Well, again, going back to Wiley, he said that Perry was angry that they discontinued flogging. And I think
it's more complicated than that. Perry didn't like the idea of dropping flogging. On the other hand, he was on the board that reviewed it, and he never protested. If it were up to Perry and most other senior admirals, he would have continued flogging. However, because he was a very, very strict disciplinarian. However, I would say that on balance, Perry's naval service was stunningly good and even progressive. He was always for more professionalism, for higher training. He fought for a naval academy. He led the crusade, and it had to be a crusade because other admirals didn't know about machinery and didn't want to know. He led the crusade for the conversion of the Navy from sail to steam, and he's rightly called the father of the steam Navy.
Okay.
Perry was a superb naval officer, but he was some of the very qualities that made him so good as a naval officer, I think, made him a very bad diplomat.
Well,
he was also by nature a bully.
Well,
he was also deeply, deeply interested in seizing bases, not just outposts, but bases, territory in Asia.
Well,
he regarded the Asians. They all did. I am not now wagging my finger in Perry's face because he behaved the way most people, Western...
I mean, the U.S. was a racist nation.
This was a racist nation. You're absolutely right. I'm not wagging my finger in Perry's face. He behaved, and it would be wrong to judge him, a 19th century, in this case, statesman, by 21st century standards. It would be wrong to do that. What I am saying, however, is we are now in the 21st century. There's no need to go on pretending that Perry pulled this beautifully benevolent act, as it's usually pictured here.
I think that
it was nothing but unbenevolent.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller.
And the source and what was the reason for the mission beneath the cloak of humanitarian purpose, which we can get into in a moment if you want to. What was the real reason for the mission, which was put over to the American public as this great humane act? It was, surprise, surprise, money. It was coal for the China trade. I can go into that further if you want to know. But, you know, there was so many parallels to our present activity, of which I had no notion when I started the book, that it's really quite remarkable. Here's the humanitarian. First of all, Perry announced, or the Secretary of Navy, they agreed with the Secretary that it was the mission's purpose to convince Japan of its Christian obligation to join the Christian family of nations. Okay, that was all the 19th century. All the 19th century believed in our superiority, absolutely. But secondly, the closing of Japan the seclusion included some acts which we would find to be pretty grim. They promised death, warned of death, to any foreigner who intruded, non-Dutch, that is, illegally intruded. In matter of fact, some foreigners did intrude, including some very brave Americans, and they got the opposite of death. They got decently treated. So the Japanese bark was very much bigger than the bite. They were shooting their mouths off, trying to frighten people to stay away. But when people actually landed there, they were treated decently, except for the shipwrecked sailors. Who were these sailors? From what ships were these sailors? Well, they were from the whalers, which were the Japanese, the northern Japanese waters teemed with American whalers because whales had been depleted in other oceans, and the last remaining place was in the North Pacific. And our ships were out there, as many as thousands and tens of thousands of them, whalers out there, making a lot of money. And some of them inevitably, the weather's bad there, and some of them inevitably grounded and otherwise went into distress. And sailors, a few sailors, landed on Japanese shores, and they were not treated the way shipwrecked sailors should be treated. They were not, to put it the other way, hugely mistreated the way American newspapers claimed at the time. But they were not, I would say it was a pretty ugly practice all in all. However, the practice had stopped before Perry sailed in 1852, and he knew it had stopped. Nevertheless, in the boondoggle, in the sort of weapons of mass destruction boondoggle of its day, if you want to make the parallel to, again, to the current time, Perry nevertheless behaved as he knew perfectly well that the practice had stopped and the Japanese had begun to act humanely toward American shipwrecked sailors. Nevertheless, he wailed and cried and shouted and threatened, to the astonishment of the Japanese, who only believed that since they had stopped the practice, Perry surely wanted to do more. So he went out there shouting about these humanitarian motives, which were all baloney, huey, and he really went out there for coal. Japan lay on the shortest route to the China trade. The China trade was extremely lucrative, and Perry was connected with it, as were many high naval officers at the time. They were in bed, Perry, literally because of family interests, with American mercantile interests. So the China trade, this lucrative trade, depended on fast ships. Well, the new steamships burned vast amounts of coal. Japan had coal. Perry knew that. And a certain number of Americans said, without a tongue in their cheek, absolutely seriously, that God had placed the coal in Japanese land for our use, for the ships going to the China trade. That was the purpose of the mission. Nothing humanitarian about it, really. Now, as I say, you can draw your own parallels to the oil of 2006 if you want to. I think there are some parallels there, although no two events in history are exactly parallel. But, you know, we've got to be a little skeptical of our own shouting about all the good we want to do people in the world, when in fact what most of us really want to do is prosper. I won't put it any more sharply than that.
Mm-hmm. I have another caller here, and perhaps also for the benefit of anybody who has just tuned in, I should introduce again our guest, George Pfeiffer. He's the author of many books, a number of them about Russia, also some about Japan. His new book is titled Breaking Open Japan, that takes a look at this moment in 1853, the forced opening of the country by the United States, when this effort led by Commodore Matthew Perry. The book is Breaking Open Japan, Commodore Perry, Lord Abe, and American Imperialism in 1853, and tries to take a look at this event not just from the American point of view, but also from the Japanese point of view, and mentions in the subtitle the man Masahiro Abe, who was the counselor to the shogun, who ended up having to be the one to be in charge of deciding what the Japanese response was going to be.
The Japanese were in a lose-lose situation. You're absolutely right. And I just want to say this. Mm-hmm. Abe Masahiro was in charge, really, because the shogun, who was ill anyway, died within 2 weeks of the arrival of the black ships. The shock wasn't what killed him alone, but the shock of what he called the most extraordinary event since the beginning of heaven and earth. That is, the arrival of these big ships with their big guns threatening and firing. And Perry, who by nature, as I say, was a bully, was absolutely delighted when he saw fear in Japanese eyes. The shock of the arrival of the America squad, the American squadron, killed him, helped kill him within 2 weeks. So all the terrible decisions of this lose-lose situation came to be the burden of this relatively genial and decent and progressive and Masahiro Abe, the Japanese leader, who in peacetime would have been a terrific leader. And he did his best, and he was torn apart. And by nature, he was a decent man. And without apologizing to anyone, I end my book with a bow to him, because I think war was avoided not because of Perry, whose threats and intimidation was naked, but because Abe managed to quell the Japanese samurai who wanted to fight no matter what the odds were.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller here. Here we have someone in Champaign. That's line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to bring up 2 points that you touched on. First, let me start with the earlier period when you talk about the closing of Japan and you talk about it as withdrawal and putting the head in the sand and things like that. In a way, the closing of Japan was really a reflection as to a great extent of a major change in Japanese politics. The fact that no longer did you have the daimyos having independent power, but you had a centralized government under the Tokugawa. And this was something that hadn't really existed in Japan prior. I mean, you had 2 shoguns just before him who were struggling to gain control
of the entire country, right? To stop the brutal savage civil wars that which were so draining. Yes,
the ongoing fighting. So,
right.
In part, the killing of Christians, the expulsion of Christians, was in part a reflection of the unification of Japan, and had less to do with the externals. I mean, the Christians and the Spanish and the Portuguese were a secondary factor, if even that, maybe even a tertiary factor, because really what was happening was you were having a major sea change in the power, in the control of the society, and the Tokugawa started to control the society in authoritarian ways which hadn't existed. They controlled on all sorts of levels. Now, let me just shift.
I'd like you to pursue that a little bit and tell me.
Go ahead. Say something, because right. I think this connects with Perry in another way, because when Perry comes, you have just the opposite. You have the ending of the Tokugawa period, ending of its controls, ending of the limitations in terms of social mobility, increased amount less hierarchical control. I'm particularly interested in the changes in Buddhism, just because of my own interest. And with the beginning of the Meiji period, which grows out of Perry's coming, you've got major changes in the nature of the relationship between government and Buddhist temples, and the nature of Buddhist use of the government to enforce various rules, or, to say it the other way, you have an increased amount of freedom for various Buddhist groups to do things which the central government didn't allow them under the Tokugawa. The Tokugawa were a very controlling society where they controlled travel, they controlled who had what occupation, who you could have contact with, and so on and so forth. So I'll just stop there and let you...
I'll start with the first thing first. I don't see the relationship that you make between the establishment of Tokugawa rule for the unread here. I will say that previous to the establishment of Tokugawa, Japan's central authority didn't exist, really. There was a century of absolutely vicious internal feudal fights. But The early Tokugawas welcomed Christianity, so that seems to shoot a little bit of a hole in your theory. It was the early Tokugawas not only welcomed Christianity, but they sent some Christian boys abroad that charmed the courts of Europe and so forth and so on. There was a turn. It wasn't. I see no direct relationship between the fear of the establishment of Tokugawa rule and the fear of Christianity. I think what happened was, although I'm not as strong about this as I would like to be, I think what was happened is that once central control was established by the Tokugawas, an absolutely, unlike your description or hint of it, I think most Japanese would think that that was a great step forward because it stopped the terrible bloodletting. And although there were restrictions of all sorts, nevertheless, they had peace and prosperity for 2.5 centuries. And Japanese were very grateful for that. Most Japanese were enormously grateful for that, although there were lots of restrictions under which you now would chafe.
Can I say something to that?
Just let me finish my sentence about the... But the early Tokugawas didn't want to repress Christianity. It was after they suspected that the Christians were in league with some of the people who they thought were trying to overthrow them. And I think they were in league. There's evidence that we can't be certain of that, but that there was evidence that there was a lot of plotting on the part of the Jesuits. It was after that the Tokugawa people came down and put in the Exclusion Acts. There was no direct relationship between the establishment of Tokugawa rule and anti-Christian attitudes that I know of. It took place later.
Later is not very far, but let me say the early Tokugawa were not the shogun. The Tokugawa was just a high-ranking daimyo like some of the other lords.
Yeah, but he then became the shogun.
Wait. And it was the first Tokugawa shogun who first crucified thousands of Christians. And crucifixion was a normal Japanese punishment, and created the expulsion of it was Aisu Tokugawa who did that. So yeah, I think
this is a bit too arcane here to go into.
Okay,
but
so
I just
we'll
want to say, for most people, this is a relatively minor matter for most people, and slightly to the side. I just want to say, all the elements are there as you put them, but I don't see the causal relationship that you're trying to establish. I would question that. The elements are there, but I don't buy the way that you say that the establishment of Tokugawa rule was the reason that they turned against the Christians. I don't see that.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because we're coming to the point where we have about 5 minutes left.
Right.
And maybe one further question I'd like to ask for those people who would argue that the United States came with benign intentions. If the Japanese had refused, what was Perry prepared to do?
That's a absolute question, unanswered question. There's evidence to believe that that's a secondary question, I think. I'll put it slightly differently than that. Okay. What did the Japanese think Perry was going to do? We do not know whether he would have fired his guns in anger, but he gave the Japanese plenty of reason to believe that's what he would do, and he did this consciously. One more thing I'd like to say, David, which is, I think, utterly important here. I'm trying to get people to look at it from the Japanese point of view, because they were the victims here. I say victims, so they were also the benefactors. I understand a lot of good things came in, but they were the people on whom force was exerted. Don't forget that 9 years before Perry's arrival, one of the most horrible things ever happened in Asia, and that is the Opium Wars to China's neighbor. China was forced to probably in one of the great unjust wars in the history of the world. China was defeated by the British, by a terribly small fleet, British fleet, in the Opium Wars with smaller guns than Perry had 9 years later. And the Japanese knew this, and then they went about what the British happily called slicing the melon, that is, taking the rewards from China and exploiting it viciously. Well, the Japanese knew that perfectly well. They were scared to death that the same would happen to them, and that Perry was going to do it to them. And when Perry suggested that the same exact treaty be enacted between the United States that had been enacted between Britain and China, and the Japanese knew perfectly well the terms of that treaty, it didn't assuage their fear in any way. All I'm trying to do is to get us to drop our own perspective for a moment and look at it from the Japanese side. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to do. It took me, I've been reading an awful lot of books, you know, to try to do it. And the arguments that we naturally make, and I understand this, are those in which we are grounded. But they are coming from the other side.
Well, it's clear that, as you say, that Perry, he arrived with a show of force. He wanted the Japanese to believe that if he didn't get what he wanted, he would use the force.
Would he have?
And,
I don't know.
And that your argument, you really want to give credit to Masahiro Abe, because, as you said, there were within the government, there were some people who thought that they should fight
the Americans. Fight them no matter what the odds are.
And even right. though they would have known that they were facing much superior weaponry and that they probably would lose. And I guess here, and again, we only have a couple of minutes. How in what way did Abe persuade the others in the government, particularly those people who said, well, we need to fight the Americans, not to, and to ultimately conclude the agreement and, in a sense, give the Americans everything that they want?
That's one of the hamburger patties of, not the meat, of my book. How Abe slowly got the Japanese to bow, I can put it this way, it's a bit too simplistic, to bow to reality. Mm-hmm. The reality being Perry's 68-pounders. Those were the weight of the ball of his cannon compared to the 3-pounders of the Japanese. I don't have time in our 2 minutes left to explain how Abe did it, but it took a man of huge diplomatic skill and tact and intelligence, which luckily Abe possessed, and he used it all, and as I said, died very early because of the strain. His love for sake and perhaps for women didn't help. It didn't help his health. But that's one of the points of my book, how he slowly convinced. He did something remarkable, distributed a kind of a referendum to 1,000 people in Japan asking what should be done with the black ships, and 80% or so said, fight, drive them out, fight. So originally the odds against him getting them to accept reality were very great, but then he slowly worked his magic.
What did the Japanese know about the United States before
what
this?
What did they know did then?
You said Perry knew almost nothing.
They knew a hell of a lot more than virtually nothing, but 10 times more than the Americans knew about Japan. So there was ignorance on both sides. But the Japanese, there's some books have been published, and the Japanese startled and endeared themselves to Perry. Someone mentioned the name George Washington, and Perry thought, of course, George Washington was the greatest person that ever walked the planet, and he was delighted by this, with his usual egotism or nationalism. Perry was more than a nationalist. We were all nationalists in the 19th century. Perry was a super nationalist, and it was our misfortune, I think, to be represented by such a man. And I want to say that the unintended consequences of using force are often very great. One unintended consequence was Pearl Harbor. I wonder now what the unintended consequences of our use of force in 2006 will be for our children or grandchildren. I wouldn't count out the possibility that there will be unintended consequences. In a way, Perry's use of force is an object lesson, I think. Mm. Perhaps, as I say, no two events in history are exactly parallel. But there is some food for thought, I think, in his use of force, and the tragic consequences.
And you're just finally, just very quickly, your argument is that still today this colors, influences, shapes the relationship between the United States and Japan.
Utterly without question.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this morning. I think it's an interesting book, and certainly for people who don't know much about Japanese history, modern Japanese history, it would be a good brief summary and certainly give them a better understanding of what is, for both sides, particularly though for the Japanese, would be probably one of the most important events in their modern history.
Thanks to you, David.
Well, I appreciate it. George Pfeiffer is our guest. Again, his book is titled Breaking Open Japan, Commodore Perry, Lord Abe, and American Imperialism in 1853. Smithsonian Books is the publisher of the book. It's out now, and I'm sure you could find it in bookstore near you if you'd like to read it.